Hello and welcome to the podcast. My name's Ajlaine.
And I'm Gracie. I forgot what my name is for a second. Holy shit.
Whoa. Okay, Gracie.
It's been a long day.
Yeah, it has been a long day.
It's only 11:30.
Jesus Christ. Okay, guys. So I'm Ajlaine and this is Gracie, who just forgot her name, even though she has the easiest name of the two of us. That is, you know, it's pretty easy to remember, you know, but you can tell that she has nothing. She has nothing to do with her name, because when it comes to being graceful, well.
Oh, man.
We're just going with this. So, yeah, we are just a podcast where we put movies to both feminist and inclusive tests. And then we ask the most important question of them all. Is the movie good?
It's true. Are you sure? I've lost it. No. So this week, we are going to be continuing our Indigenous people, Indigenous films about Indigenous people by Indigenous people. And this week, we are doing Rhymes for Young Ghouls, which is an indie film out of Canada. And it's about reservation life in the 1970s. And it's pretty good. It's pretty good. This movie was directed and written by Jeff Barnaby. Jeff Barnaby has also written and directed The Colony and Blood Quantum. He's done some shorts. He is a Mi'kmaq film director who grew up in Listigouge Reserve in Quebec, Canada. So he's definitely Canadian.
Can you this, tell?
Huh?
Can you tell?
Yeah, I could tell. So this film stars Devery Jacobs as Ayla. Devery Jacobs is from Quebec, Canada as well. She's best known for American Gods and Cardinal outside of Rhymes for Young Ghouls.
She is also Mohawk.
Yes.
Which is different than it's a different tribe.
Yes.
I don't know what the actual name of the Mohawk tribe is. I'm so sorry, but it's a long name.
Yeah. She's also been in the very shortly received The Order TV show. So, then we have Glenn Gould as Joseph. He's been in things like Unsettled, Monkey Beach, The Secret History Of, and he was also in Cardinal. Glenn is originally from the Mi'kmaq community of Member 2 First Nation, located on Unimaki, Cape Breton, Nova Scotia.
Did you say that the main actress was in American Gods?
Yes.
Okay. Apparently, I don't listen to Gracie. I'm so sorry.
It happens. But yeah, Glenn Gould is also from the Mi'kmaq community. Mm-hmm. Brandon Oakes plays Burner. He has been in things like Digstown. He was in Anne with an E. He was in Bad Blood. He is an American Canadian actor, Mohawk, from the Akwesasne, which straddles the U.S.-Canadian border.
Also, Digstown is like a really fantastic show that's based out of Halifax, Nova Scotia. And it is, and I'm going to tout it because it really is a fantastic show. It stars a black Nova Scotian woman as like the main character as a lawyer. And it's like a legal aid clinic in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia. And like it's got a very diverse cast for being like such a small TV show in a very like, because Halifax is pretty fucking small. Like it's not a big city in Canada. It's like number 12, maybe, if we're fucking lucky. So anyways, sorry.
It's fine.
Fantastic show. Watch it.
Then we have Roseanne Supernault, who is Metis, and she has been in the Jamestown TV series and Blackstone TV series. So, you know, I just appreciated that there were so many people in this film who were Indigenous to Canada. It's definitely a Canadian movie, and it's good. I think out of the movies so far that we've watched this week, this one has been my favorite. And it's an indie film that I'd never heard of until I started looking for Indigenous movies, which really infuriates me, because it's like, goddamn, I wish we had I wish some of these really great movies had, like,
well, big company. We started watching this other movie.
Oh, it was so bad.
Which was Holy shit. It had, like, this weird white savor. Like, despite the fact that, like, all of the actors were Indigenous, and, like, I'm pretty sure that it was funded by an Indigenous tribe, but, like, the movie was just
the writing terrible. Was trash. It like, was the person who wrote the movie, like, the only other writing credit they had was a Talking Dog movie.
Yeah, so we ended up, we didn't even finish the movie.
We watched an hour of it, and we were like, nah, yeah. Bro.
Nah, we are not doing this. Well, because we also had somebody else, like, who was watching it with us, and they yeeted out because they were like, because there was, like, some really cartoonishly racist stuff being said at the beginning, and it was like, yeah, that's, but Jesus Christ, like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Yeah, it was bad. But this was much better. I'm glad we decided to do this one instead. Rotten Tomatoes has this with an 80% tomato meter and 75% audience. I feel like that should be higher, but that's just me. Now then, let's talk about the movie. So this movie came out in 2013, and it starts off with little Ayla and her brother, and their parents are basically involved in, like, selling drugs, right? Like, in order to make money for themselves, because they all live on, I think, the Red Crow Reservation.
Yeah, which is, it's not a real reservation, but I'm going to say it's in New Brunswick. They never specifically say, but it's like one of the Maritimes areas. And everybody speaks English, so I'm saying New Brunswick.
I feel like it takes place. The filming was probably New Brunswick. So the movie actually opens with the decree of residential schools, where it was, like, by Her Majesty, like, from the office of Her Majesty, talking about how these children should be taken from their homes and placed in these residential schools. And if they don't, and if they are truant, then their parents or whoever takes care of them should also be punished.
Mm-hmm.
Fun.
And that's the thing. That was
a real
that
decree.
That was the law. Yeah. That was, like, the real decree for like over 100 years. Like, we watched that other movie a couple of years ago, Where the Spirit Lives. Like, there were still residential schools when that movie came out in the late 1980s.
Yeah,
the last school closed in 1996.
Yeah, and this movie is about a residential school on a reservation in the early 70s. So, like, it was still a thing in the 70s. We meet, Ayla. Ayla's, like, an artist like her mom is. And one of the things that ends up happening right at the beginning of the movie is, unfortunately, her little brother is accidentally run over while they're leaving, where they've been drying out weed and stuff. And so Ayla's mother, after accidentally killing her son, ends up committing suicide.
Because that's the thing, is Ayla's parents consume drugs and alcohol to cope with their abuse that they suffered at the residential school, and that is a very true statement that many Indigenous families are still dealing with to this day, and the ongoing like generational trauma that has come from that.
Oh, absolutely. So what ends up happening is her brother Tyler is killed accidentally. Her mother ends up committing suicide, and then her father is put in prison, essentially for manslaughter. And this is where we meet Joseph, who is a priest, and he's terrible. He's the worst. They call him Popper because he's a father and he works at the local residential school. Saint
Joseph is the father.
Oh, my bad. Like not father. Joseph. Not Joseph. Popper. Popper is by Mark Anthony Krupta. My bad. We just call him Popper. My bad. But anyway, Popper is an Indian agent.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. They mention that they have certain rules, and one of them is don't befriend the Indian agent, because there were people across, and some of them were Indigenous as well, but they were, their job for the government was to essentially make sure that children were going to school.
Mm-hmm.
And we see it in, like, Where the Spirit Lives, where, like, that one guy, like, is in the in the plane, goes to the reserve and, like, basically kidnaps all those children.
Yeah. Oh, well, with, you like, know, candy. Get some candy. Yeah. Yeah. That's Popper's job. And he's in charge of St. Dimphna's, which is the residential school for the children on the Mi'kmaq reservation. And he is corrupt. Very, very corrupt. In fact, he actually lets Ayla not go to that school by having her pay him a truancy tax. So he's getting very rich off of the people that he is in charge of by saying, yeah, I won't turn you over, you know, as long as you pay me for it. So he's very corrupt. He's a terrible human being. He exploits exploits everyone that he can in order to fill his own pockets. He's also a sexual abuser of the boys at the school.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about it a few times. I don't think they actually show it in detail, but they do talk about it, which, historically speaking, there was a lot of sexual abuse and physical abuse at these schools.
Well, like, if you hear... They have film series, actually, on... online, where they have survivors go and talk about their experiences, and it's absolutely fucking heartbreaking. But essentially, like, Ayla has taken over her father's drug dealing business in the care of her uncle, Burner, who, you know, himself consumes and sells the drugs.
Yes.
So she, and she just happens to be, like, really good at rolling joints.
Yeah, and she does different kinds of joints for, you know, she has some joints that they dip in brandy to make people feel better. Then they have some that are made with honey for, like, the vegans, I guess. Right? Like, when she was going through the different types of joints she rolls, I was like, wow, that's kind of funny. You know, like...
But it's true, though. Like, I mean, some... like, weed in it... Like, weed in itself, though, like, especially with growing, I don't know if this is what a lot of people know, but when it comes to, like, honey, right? Like, there's different tasting honey depending on what the bees, like, the flowers that the bees collect from. Like, commercial honey is usually clover, I want to say.
Yeah.
So there's that. And then it's the kind of the same with, like, like, weed and growing, like, certain ways. Like, there's different brands, you know? There's different ways to, like, make you feel better or whatever. Like, I don't know the full scope of it, but, you know, plant science and pot science is very interesting.
Very nice. So one of the things that this movie really does not shy away from is just the abject poverty that a lot of these people who live on this reservation live in. Like, mm-hmm. these kids, like, they live in rundown houses. They, you know, they hang out in junky, like, junkyards, essentially. Like, the poverty is there. Like, and it, they don't shy away from it. But I will say what this film does that I really appreciate is, despite the fact that there is a lot of misery in this movie, there are moments of levity and moments that make you laugh and moments of, like, humanity, which I really appreciate. And even though we know Popper is a horrible, shitty human being, he's not cartoonish in his evilness. He seems very realistic, very much in the same way when Ajeline and I have watched, like, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, right? Where Frollo, yeah. to me, is probably Disney's most effective villain just because he's the most realistic. I get the same vibe with Popper. Like, he's awful, but also it is entirely believable that he's that fucking racist and that much of a fucking sadistic shit. Like, there's this one scene in the movie where he's talking to the new kids that have come to this residential school, and he's like, you're going to behave or we're gonna send you up for a long drive, which historically speaking was when, you know, they would take these kids up, or, you know, people who were in any kind of custody, regardless of age, take them up to the mountains and then just drop them off and then drive back down, and then they would starve or freeze to death up in the mountains.
Which they did for years. The RCMP did that for years in Saskatoon and other parts of Saskatchewan, and it was called Saskatoon Twilight Tours. And the only reason why people found out about it is because somebody survived. But they were doing this for years, and many people didn't survive because of that. Yeah. That's fucking horrifying.
Absolutely. It's absolutely horrifying. So even though it's not something that they show in the movie, it's something they interject. And you can definitely tell that the person who did this movie, who wrote this movie, definitely has a lot of, like, historical backing, like, when he mentions some of the stuff. Like, it's not a 100% accurate portrayal, of course, but you can definitely tell that it's coming from an Indigenous perspective, you know? Mm-hmm. So Ayla, you know, she hustles with weed and stuff to make ends meet and to make sure that her truancy tax is paid so she doesn't have to go to the residential school. But what ends up happening is Popper ends up forming this raid on a local strip club and takes one of her partners.
It's called the Fish Mitten.
Yeah, that didn't matter.
I know, but it was a gross name.
It was
such a gross name.
So what ends up happening is her partner ends up getting all of his money taken. Mm-hmm. So now they realize that Popper has taken all of their money, and they decide they're going to try and get it back from him. And that, unfortunately, requires somehow getting into the school where Popper works without actually getting into the school. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So they're trying to formulate this plan, and while this is happening, Ayla's dad ends up being released from prison, and he comes back. So not only is this about trying to get even with Popper, it's about her reconnecting with her father, who has been in prison for 10 years. And when he comes back, he's definitely haunted by whatever he's had to go through as a prison inmate. He's still haunted by the memory of his wife and his child who died. And he's absolutely enraged at the fact that even though he wanted what was best for Ayla, she's having to resort to the same sorts of things he did. And it was so heartbreaking when he has that conversation with her and he's like, this is not what I wanted for you. This is not what wanted for you. And I think that speaks to how a lot of people who grow up in abject poverty, who use drug trafficking in order to put food on the table, you know, like, they don't want that for their kids. It's very dangerous. It's very unsafe. You know, they don't want their children to do the same thing that they had to do to survive. But poverty keeps you in poverty. Like, the entire system works against you to keep you there. And so you have to exploit what you can. And so Ayla has been forced to resort to that.
Can't you just pull up your bootstraps and work harder to get more money? Please note I'm just joking.
Yeah, I know you're just joking, but it's just like, ugh. But that's the thing, though. Like, it's the same argument as, like, when people bring up the racist dog whistle, like Chicago, right? Or inner city violence, you know? Like, or they talk about, well, why do these kids do these things? Like, we've talked about this when we talked about The Hate U Give. I think The Hate U Give and Rhymes for Young Ghouls have a lot in common as far as, like, the kind of narrative they're trying to tell. They're showing trauma of adults through the eyes of kids, right? Because Ayla's only 15. And she's about the same age as the girl from The Hate U Give. I can't remember her name off the top of my head. But essentially, both of them are having to deal with systemic issues that they did not create. And they're having to work around those systemic issues in order to survive. And one of the things I ended up writing on Twitter, which I wanted to discuss here, was how these two films, to me, do something that other films by white people don't do, right? Like, when you watch a movie like Freedom Riders, or you watch a movie like The Help, right? Which are written about, you know, people of color, but from a white perspective. You get this idea that at the end of the movie, racism is over, right? Like, we solved it, you know? Same with Green Book.
We did it, guys. Let's call it a day.
We did it. We pat ourselves on the back. Same thing with Crash, right? Yeah. Where you have this, like, narrative of, like, oh, white people helped save the day. And then you have movies like The Hate U Give and movies like this, where you have the adults expressing to their children what they wanted to be different. Like, The Hate U Give, the father, Maverick, right? He, you know, pushed drugs, and he was a drug dealer, and, you know, he was a Black Panther, and he did whatever he could to put food on the table, and he went to prison when his daughter was just a baby, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the same sort of situation with Ayla here, where her father was having to turn to hustling drugs in order to keep food on the table, and then he ends up going to prison. And it's just sad because it excuse me. It's just so fucking terrible, right? And then because there are films that were created through people of color, right? It's their voices that are doing it. The movies and the books that they're based on don't end with, we solved racism, everybody. Racism is over. Instead, it's kind of like this, we've won one battle, but there's still so much more that needs to happen, right? When The Hate U Give ends, it's a bittersweet ending because there is no justice for the kid that got shot by the police officer. There's just, like, a resolve that things can get better if we work towards it. This movie ends essentially, like, very tragically, but there's still, like, this almost hope to it. Like, things can get better if we work towards it. And it's just, it's just frustrating because these films don't get as much, like, money. They don't get as much corporate response as films from a white perspective. And it sucks.
Oh, 100%.
It sucks ass.
And the other thing, too, that they kind of show in a flashback scene that, like, Popper, as a young man, was bullied by several Mi'kmaq or Mi'kmaq youths, including Burner. And then that's when Joseph, like, goes to his aid and, like, stops, you know, that bullying, only for Popper to, like, spur that and, like, tell on him. And then Joseph got in trouble. And, like, that's how Popper developed, like, a hatred for the indigenous in the reserve.
Yeah, because he was bullied. And then, when someone rescued him, because that person was not white, he still hated him. Right?
Yeah.
That's why racists aren't your friends. Like, there's so much going on right now talking about how you know, people need to work across the aisle. And it's like, I have zero empathy for any fucking person who is a white supremacist or a Nazi, or who enabled white supremacy and Nazism and, like, fascism. Like, fuck those people. Like, I should not have to, you know, to work with those people or be nice to them in order to, you know, for them to treat me with any kind of respect. A real person would treat someone with respect regardless. So, like, fuck that narrative that we need to be nice to our oppressors.
And that's the thing. There are tons of stories, like, of, like, oh, hey, here's this. Because there is a gentleman that, I can't for the life of me remember his name, but he essentially goes and, like, talks to white supremacists and, like, you know, gets them to not be racist anymore or something, which, like, good on him. Like he's able to, like, do that. It's not a requirement. But that is not a requirement for, you know, people of color to try to, you know, bridge the gap. Like, no. There's a lot of shit that, like, those people who are racist need to fucking do. They need to be the ones to actually do the work.
But as we know.
But they're not gonna.
But as we know, calling someone racist is worse than them actually being racist. Supposedly.
Yeah.
Like, that's how it's treated. Like, when a person of color, when a black, indigenous, or other person of color says, hey, that's racist, and then the racist gets mad about being called racist, it is their anger at being called racist that is considered worse than the actual racism. And that's that's like a systemic, like, societal issue. And it's gotta fucking stop. Like,
oh, 100%. Like, oh my God, white people get so mad, like, it's when you're like, when you fragility. Call them out. Oh, yeah. And if you call them out, they're just like, oh, well, I'm a good person. I'm not racist.
You can still be a, like, good person and be racist.
Yeah.
It's, like, it's like all those people coming to Chris Pratt's aid a few weeks ago, right? Like,
oh,
he's a good person. He wore a Don't Tread on Me shirt. And he's married to married into a family of Republicans who support Trump.
But Gracie, he's a good person.
But he's a good person.
Yeah, he's, like, really, you know, he's a good person, and he's really funny on set, and we've talked, like, a few times, so he's got to be a good guy.
But no, you know, love.
Despite the fact.
But no, yeah. But no love for your female coworker who was sent death and rape threats and only had one person come to her aid publicly.
Yeah.
But, you know. What do I know? Yeah. So. Yeah. So there is a societal issue where, like, people are more angry at being called racist than they are at the actual racism, right? Like, it's the same as, you know, like, when people get called out for their racist shit and they're like, but I don't see color. Fuck off. Fuck off.
Oh, my
off.
God. And I will tell you, too, like, okay, so when the whole thing with, like, George Floyd was happening, right? Like, there was a lot of, like, white women or like white people who are like, what, I'm racist, oh my God. And, like, you know, and I talked to my mom so much about this. Like, I was trying to, like, work with her and being like, hey, you know, yeah, like, what, everybody is a bit racist, but, like, you can work on this and, like, you know, to, like, you have to work on yourself. You have to realize that, like, yeah, there's things, like, there's a difference between, like, what you think and what, like, what you thought and what you were, like, taught. And then, like, that second voice that goes, yeah, no. Like.
Yeah, right.
Like who you are as a real person.
You basically have to unindoctrinate yourself with the racist ideology that you have been taught. Mm-hmm. And it's hard. I still struggle with it, right? Like.
Yeah.
The idea is to not be, like, you know, not racist, to be anti-racist, to basically have those things in your head and reject them 100%, because these are things that are not good, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, trying to get back to the movie, like, I don't know, we ended up on a tangent, but
no, but, like, I mean, I think that this is an important conversation, right? Like, there is, because I can tell you, like, both my parents are pretty fucking racist.
And, oh,
like, I was raised racist. And, like, more so than, like, I was raised in a very white background, a very white community.
Yeah. Yeah, whereas so, I had a more diverse upbringing with after I left private school and was in a public school setting. But even me, 11, 12 years old, wearing Dixie Outfitter t-shirts that had rebel flags on them or Confederate flags on them and thinking that it's not racist, it's just heritage, not hate, and having to basically unlearn all of that bullshit, bullshit that I was taught, because the Confederate flag represents slavery and oppression, and it's a symbol of hatred. It's no better than a fucking swastika on a Nazi flag, right? And it's just the matter of, like, having to come to terms with that. And you should be able to grow enough as a person to realize that, you know, maybe some of the shit you were taught as a kid isn't right. Maybe some of the shit you were taught as a kid isn't correct. Maybe it's racist. Maybe you should look into that more. Maybe you should do better as a person. And speaking as a white person, you know, it's on us, right? People of color, Black, Indigenous, and other people of color, do not have to spend their time placating you. You have to do the work yourself, and it's hard. But if you want to be a better person and more inclusive, you need to do the fucking work instead of crying about it when someone calls you out for something. Because I've been called out for saying problematic shit, and then, or I've seen something that has made me uncomfortable, and I've had to go in and think about it. Like, there was a Twitter feed thing that ended up going viral last year where a guy, a Black man, essentially said, you know, that white people treat their dogs better than they do Black people. And I was like, that's not true. But then I looked at it from a historical context, and it is true. It is true. It is true. People will make excuses for a dog biting a Black person before they, like there was a picture of a German shepherd attacking a Black man in the 1960s. Like a police German shepherd. And he asked, would you shoot that dog? And there was hesitation in my thought process. And then I was like, of course I would shoot that dog if it meant saving that person. But a lot of times the people would be like, oh, but it's just an innocent dog. It was only taught that. It's not their fault. They're making excuses. So you have to kind of like look at it from that perspective. You have to basically change the way you think because you have been taught to think in a very white way. So, yeah. White supremacy is rampant. You gotta work on that shit.
It's in every fabric and every being of our institution, and we need to unlearn, and we need to change it, and sooner rather than fucking later, because it's costing fucking lives.
It's true. Now, this movie, again, doesn't have, like, a super big plot. Like, the plot is just her reconnecting with her father. And what ends up happening is her uncle ends up spilling the beans about the fact that they're trying to break into the school to get the money. So she gets forced into the school. And one of the most heartbreaking scenes in this movie is when she is being bathed and then the nuns are cutting her hair. And it's such a disgusting thing because hair is so vitally important a lot of times. And to have long hair just cut right off of you just because
it... Well, that's the other thing, too. For Indigenous people, like, long hair is a part of their culture. I don't know if it is with Mi'kmaq because, like, every tribe is obviously different, right? But that moment of, like, her... Because, like, even before that, like, when they were stripping her of her clothes or whatever, but it wasn't until the haircut where I physically, like, I make a sound and you were like, Angelina, are you okay?
Yeah, like, we both.
Because it just.
Because I also went, Jesus fucking Christ. Like, that was my response. I was like, God, how fucking horrible. Because that would be like burning a cross in front of a Christian, you know? Like. It's just so culturally important, and for you to just take it away like that with no regard for the person you're harming, it's just so fucking, you know, like, it's part of their identity, and you're stripping their identity away to make them more white. Fuck off. Do better. Goddamn. Mm-hmm. So, she ends up getting put basically in this dungeon, but the thing is, it was all part of the plan, baby. She ends up getting rescued by one of the kids that actually is in the residential school, And then they end up managing to, like, catch up with her friends. They clog the fucking pipes with actual shit. It was so gross.
Oh, yeah. And they, like, said something where they were like, yeah, surprisingly, a lot of people were willing to donate to this cause. And I was like,
oh, God.
It was disgusting to watch. But they put it in there, and I was just like, I was really trying hard not to puke. So then they go up to the office, like to Popper's office, where he has everything's in a lockbox, and like they hide when Popper comes in. And at that point, I was like, just fucking hit him with a bat at that moment. But they don't for whatever reason. And I mean, there is a reason. So it ends up that she goes into, because he's taking a shower, or he's about to take a shower, and then she steals the key while he's in the shower. But like, there's a part where like he's, you know, turning on the tap, and then he's like, puts his hand out, and then suddenly there's like this spurt of shit all over him, and he falls back, and like he's got the curtain wrapped around him, right? And he's like yelling while she's like running to grab the like the money out of the thing, like out of the safe.
I saw,
and they get
dick.
Like $20,000. Yeah,
I saw dick. But they end up escaping. Woo!
Yeah, and they end up... Oh, and they also free her father, because her father... That's the thing. This movie has a lot of violence. Like, a lot of violence.
Oh, yeah. It's very bloody.
Very bloody. But they free her father, and then they steal $20,000 in 1976. So that was, like, a lot of money. And then, yeah, the... After escaping, Ayla does reconcile with her father, who tells her that she's not to blame for the death of her mother, and that the cycle of abuse, you know, that occurred in the residential school.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Popper knows that Ayla and her friends have stolen the money, and he ends up going to one of them and ripping his fucking teeth out until he confesses. So then he shows up at Ayla's place, and he beats the shit out of her dad, and then almost sexually assaults her. Like, I had to stop the movie. I was like, oh God, I don't want to watch this. But the good thing is, he doesn't end up sexually assaulting her, because a little kid ends up coming in, the same little kid that had been at the residential school, and he shoots Popper in the head with the shotgun. Y'all, I have never seen graphic flapping skin on the side of a person's face in a movie before.
It was pretty graphic.
It was pretty fucking graphic.
Yeah. It was,
I was like,
it was gross.
Jesus fucking Christ. Like, you could see brain and, like, shattered skull. I was like, whoever did the makeup on this did a really fucking good job, because it looks like he really did get his head shot off.
So, to protect the young boy and his daughter, Joseph takes the fall for killing Popper. And then, Ayla is taken in by a friend of her grandfather. The guy is called the old man because I guess he had gone to war or something and aged 1,000 years. And you do meet him like a little bit before, like in the movie, because they do mention that Ayla had aged 1,000 years the day her mother committed suicide, and then this other guy has aged 1,000 years because of his time in the war, right?
Yeah, like, he joined the military at 16, and, you know, because he wanted to join the military to fight in the war, and then it ended up, like, just basically destroying his outlook on humanity because of the trauma. So...
So this friend of her grandfather ends up becoming, like, a mentor to her, and then promises that he's gonna, you know, help her get away from, like, the life of dealing drugs. And then The young boy who also saved her, like, he's part of the mix too, so it's like not a happy ending,
but there's an optimism. Like, there's an optimism, yeah, which again harkens back to how The Hate U Give ends, right, where you don't get justice for the person who is murdered unjustly, but you get a sense of at least peace for the moment, where it's like there's still so much that needs to be done, so much that needs to be rectified, but we could do better. But the tragicness of all of this is the person who suffers the least is Popper. Like, he gets to die quickly, right? But her father has to spend more years in a fucking prison cell just to protect her from that same outcome. It's so self-sacrificing and so fucking disgusting that he has to do that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the movie.
Now, there isn't any trivia, at all.
That's all right. I think this movie's really good.
I do have to say, though, the music in this movie is fantastic.
Oh, for sure. The score and the way it kind of, like, harps on, it's like a mixture of indigenous and old gospel in some aspects. Mm-hmm. Like, there's that one scene where she's basically in the dungeon of the school, and it's, like, almost, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, a gospel choir kind of sound to it. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. And then there's, like, drum beats and stuff in other parts. It's real good. It's real good.
Yeah.
Now, as far as the tests are concerned, it does pass the Bechdel test because she has conversations with her grandmother about just herself, or that conversation with her mother while they're painting the door. Like, she's having that flashback of her, you know, painting the door. So that's a pass. And then you have, it definitely passes the McElmory test and the DuVernay test and the racial Bechdel test because they're all people of color in one form or another, you know, and talking about issues that aren't a white narrative. And then we have the sexy lamp test. Ayla's really the only female character outside of her grandmother. And I think her grandmother is pivotal enough. And her mother.
Oh, there.
And her mother.
There is Tammy.
Oh, there's Tammy too. Oh, well, we could replace Tammy with a sexy lamp.
Her name is Tammy, though.
Yeah.
That was like she barely has like any lines in it, but it, like, it's essentially like they're at that party or whatever, and then they're like, sorry, what's your name? And she's like, my name's Tammy. And then there's the part where, like, they're kicking her out the next day, and she's like, God damn it, my name's Tammy. And, like, she runs out or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And they're like, get the fuck out.
So, yeah, I guess we could, you know, say that
Tammy's the sexy lamp.
Tammy's the sexy lamp. Vita Russo test, you have people who are, on the GSRM spectrum that have a gender sexual or romantic minority. Nothing overt. You can't tell. So I'm going to say it's a fail on that. And then the KES test, you have people who are neurodivergent or who are disabled. Do they matter to the plot? Are they more than just their neurodivergency or their disability? You don't really see that either. So, all that aside though, I think the message, is very feminist because it's about Ayla having to come into her own. And it's also about her trying to survive the systemic racism that surrounds her, and just surviving in general. So I think it's good. It's a very good, very good movie. I really liked it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this movie as well. And like, it was fantastic. I do want to, like, share, I know we don't have any trivia, but I wanted to, like, share a little thing that I thought was very interesting.
Yeah, go ahead.
About the main actress. So, in 2019, the second season of American Gods, she plays the young Cherokee college student, Sam Black Crow, who self-identifies as two-spirited. In an interview, she says, I identify as queer, not two-spirited, because I'm Mohawk and we don't have that. And that Neil Gaiman, the author, of course, of the novels, strongly advocated for her to be cast in that role.
Yeah. Hell yeah. You love to see
it. So I thought that was pretty... I thought that was pretty cool.
Absolutely. I guess that's it for this episode. We have one more episode of Indigenous Films to watch. We're going to be watching The Sapphires, which I think is an Australian movie.
Yeah.
And, of course, you can check us out twitch.tv/feministcritique. I think the person we should highlight this week is Nbody, who is an artist and cartoonist. They don't have a lot of followers, and they really deserve it. So if you like watching art streams and you like watching people talk art and talk politics, definitely check out Embody. It's twitch.tv/embody. Definitely worth your time. Give them all the follows.
Yes, 100%. I also do want to mention Universal Discourse, just because they talk a lot about Indigenous issues on theirs. And I know we already highlighted somebody, but yeah,
it's you should fine also to check out two people. That's cool.
Yeah. You should check them out too, because they're pretty awesome.
twitch.tv/universaldiscourse. Please. Absolutely do. And you can check us out. Our official Twitter is at Feminist Pod, and I am on Twitter at South of Grace.
And I am also on Twitter as Ajlenes, AISLENES. And then I have my Instagram, which is my drag one, which is Aurora Borealis. That's ASS at the end rather than NIS. So.
Woo!
Woo! All right. So we will see you guys next week with the Sapphires.
Yes, absolutely. See you then. Love ya. Bye.
Love you. Bye.